coming to get you, Barbara.
I don't know what you come to do, but I come to praise name.
Because you'll never be anything but a common frump whose father lived over a grocery store and whose mother took in washing.
Hey, y'all, welcome to Who Shout Ya? It's your boy. I'm your host, Ricky Carmona. Joining me in the studio, film reviews editor at The Rep, my man, Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what is good with you, sir?
Vanessa Hudgens.
Okay.
Vanessa Hudgens.
I like just jumping in.
Just always bringing it and always good in things. And this past weekend, we got Rent Live on Fox, which, like most of the live on TV musicals, was kind of a hot mess and all over the place. And there were things here and there that worked. And my friend Emerson Collins killed it in his moments. But I got to say, Vanessa Hudgens brought it. And was just so great. And I think a friend of the show, Ira Madison, tweeted something like, we have never given Vanessa Hudgens her due.
Okay.
You know, and I Powerless, Band Slam, you name it. You know, even that Netflix twin princess movie, I'm down for Vanessa Hudgens.
That's what's
She's what's good.
That's what I'm talking about. Film critic, host of the Switchblade Sisters podcast, the one and only April Wolf, y'all. April, what's good with you?
I'm back on my Patricia Highsmith shit again. So,
yeah, I don't know what that means, but that's just kind of odd.
She's one of literature's crankiest lesbians.
Oh, okay.
She is.
Talk to me.
And she's like, the way that she talks about the upper class and the way that she kind of just skewers everyone, she just kind of has like a disdain and a cynicism for everyone, and it just makes me cackle, and I love it. And it's all about murder, but it's also like there's a sensitivity to it. Like, it doesn't just seem completely cold. She gets into the psychology of her characters in a way that so very few people do. And I mean, if you've ever seen The Talented Mr. Ripley, I mean, like, it's like that adaptation, I would say, is just, it's, you know, one of my favorites, too.
Strangers on a Train.
What else?
Is it Carol? No. What's Carol based on?
No, that's...
Am I confusing my cranky lesbian?
No, actually, you're right. That is Patricia Highsmith.
Okay.
You're right. Yeah.
Okay.
But she wrote, published under a pseudonym, though.
Okay. Thank God Alonzo's here.
Haven't gotten any pseudonymous works yet. But I just fucking love her. And her stuff is the kind of stuff that you can just reread and still find. There's one that I can't remember I'm reading right now, but it's so good. Like, this guy is accused of killing his wife, and like, he didn't. And he's just like, well, I'm going to play a joke on everyone and pretend that I did. And it's like, no, dude, don't do that. Even, like, you know that you're innocent, but you should not be doing that. So, yeah, Patricia Highsmith, just one of my favorite authors ever.
All right, y'all, you heard her. Get on that shit, yo. Get on that Patricia. What's her last name?
Highsmith.
Highsmith shit, yo.
Not Lowsmith.
Not Lowsmith, yo.
It's Highsmith.
And the Murder, She Wrote crossover is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
All right, okay. And the other voice that we heard there, she's back in the building. Producer, film festival programmer, Drea Clark. Drea.
I wish I had a woman of esteem from anywhere between Vanessa Hudgens and Patricia Highsmith.
There's a lot between them.
We call that a gamut.
I feel like their lockers would be near each other in high school, though. Mine is actually 100% the other direction, which is I'm weirdly obsessed with a Canadian comedy on Hulu called Letterkenny. And I'm thrilled that everyone else has finally caught up on Schitt's Creek, which I feel like I was the first one to watch. Real trendsetter over here, but only if that shit's Canadian. And Letterkenny is about this small town in Ontario, and it follows the Hicks, the Skids, which are the goths, the hockey players, and the Christians. And its creator is the main Hick, and it's also like kind of auteur shaped, so there's like only 8 episodes a season, and they're little 30-minute nuggets, and it's nice and funny, and there's amazing wordplay. Like, every episode has a scene that is just two or more characters riffing on some kind of pun, generally in a filthy manner. Which I enjoy, but it also is so sneakily progressive. And when I was looking something up about it, I found this article, and I wish I could find it. But it was from, I feel like it was like queer femme writing, but it was something that was like, Letterkenny is the most secretly queer show in Canada, which is funny because it is also the most like straight white male show you've ever seen enough. It is so funny and so good. Letterkenny, please everyone start watching it so I have someone to quote with. I keep having to Google Canadian terms. I know what chel is now. I can call a cigarette a dart. Like, I'm learning so much. Yeah, so
that's what's up.
God, I miss Degrassi.
Hey, what's up, Ricky? What's good with you?
Oh, I wish I had some like literary educational shit to tell y'all, or like some hot show I'm watching right now. But what's good with me is goddamn dog sitting, y'all. Dog sitting.
Wait,
dog sitting. Is this a pupper you brought in here once?
It's a goddamn bear practically, okay, that I was dog sitting, like a 175-pound chocolate lab.
Wow.
That is the most friendliest goddamn fucking animal in the world. The best dog. I mean, like, I don't know if y'all know this about me, but I'm poor, so I can't take vacations. But if you tell me, hey, come dog sit at my place, that's like a fucking Sandals resort to me, all inclusive. I walk in, I'm like, just leave some booze out for me. Oh, you got cable? I guess I'll be watching every movie I possibly can. Laundry on site, like in the apartment, I'm doing laundry.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
That is a luxury.
This really is living.
Damn, yo. Damn.
And a dog.
And I just got to walk this dog outside every couple of hours. Just make sure you don't shit in the house.
You got to get some, like, rich friends. I need that.
It wasn't even, I mean, it's not even a rich friend just to fucking get out of my house and look at all these other things I got. You know, just a goddamn hell of a weekend, y'all. Hell of a weekend. Oh. I mean, I was like, just all I did was I watched so many movies. I didn't want to leave the house so I could go see the movie we're talking about. I was so goddamn comfortable.
This seems like an Airbnb setup where it's like you get to go to somebody's house and just do laundry and walk their dog. And, you know, you work out a situation.
It's the best, dude. It's the best. I can't recommend it enough. If you let your friends know, hey, don't you got like an aunt in Kenosha you need to go visit?
Oh, I feel like we could set you up a weekend every year or all year long. Like, oh, you got a dog? Have I got the guy for you?
Yeah.
Have you heard the good news about Ricky?
Hey, on this show, we are going to be talking about the movie in theaters right now, Stan and Ollie, starring John C. Reilly and Steve Coogan. We are going to take a call from the Who Shot Line, and as always, we'll have our staff picks at the end of the show. But first, it's time for It a Dick, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? How it works is we're all going to read a news blurb or headline, and anybody can jump in by answering these two questions. Is this important? Do I care? We're going to start off with, man,
this
is great. I love being in my 40s and hip hop is just like everywhere now. Hip hop is at Sundance, y'all. Hip hop is at Sundance. Wu-Tang Clan is there because they announced they're making a movie based on their experiences growing up in Staten Island projects. It's going to be a supernatural thriller, April, called Angel of Dust. It's written by Ghostface Killah, and I love this, his friend-slash-manager, Caruso. You know, this is one of his boys. It's going to be directed by RZA. RZA, last movie he directed was The Man with the Iron Fist. The soundtrack is going to be done by the Wu-Tang Clan, so literally soundtrack by the RZA. And it's basically, I'll read you a really quick synopsis here. It's set in the modern day. Casey is a normal yet exceptionally smart teenager and talented rapper. But after the mysterious death of his parents, he's forced to grow up in New York's roughest inner city streets, also known as Shaolin. I knew that.
RZA never met a Shaolin he didn't like.
Thank you. Also known as Shaolin in Wu-Tang folklore, basically on his own. His life in the hood around him gets tragically worse. He must put his skills to the test to survive. Junkies, bullies... but also a serial killer with seemingly supernatural powers dubbed by the media as the Angel of Dust. Is this important? Do y'all care? From the slums of Shaolin. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
This thing's got everything.
Yes, yes. Like
gangs, really cops, junkies, bullies, a serial killer named Angel Dust, supernatural
powers. Say it like Stefan. This movie has everything. Junkies, bullies, corrupt cops.
A supernatural power called the Angel of Dust. Yeah.
I hope that RZA has gone to directing school since the last one, because Man with the Iron Fist was kind of painful.
I think I've seen pieces of it, and I remember just being like, I like that you love kung fu movies too. Now make a Now come back and knock it out, RZA. I'll be here.
Let's see
I'll
if Caruso
here.
Can add a step.
There we go.
There we go. Yeah, no, I totally agree. He knows his references.
Yeah, like I would say he's a great curator.
Yes, and he's a. I think he does a great job composing. Obviously.
Oh well, no, yeah, not even getting into that aspect of it.
But no, yeah. I agree. I think story wise, it's taking his love of that medium. And sort of meshing it with something more cohesive. And, you know, how could this go wrong? There's only a couple elements they're juggling. And everybody knows a supernatural thriller, easiest genre to pull off.
Come on. Oh, piece of cake.
Can't go wrong.
I feel like if you do something like this, you just need to go tits to the glass, just like kind of don't care about logic, and then just like go wacky, you know? Like whatever...
I'm trying to get, like, if they
be careful what you ask for.
Tales from the Hood type route, where it's just, I mean, it is able to combine all of these elements. And, I mean, some of those stories are better than other ones, but I still remember being excited about seeing that in the theater. And it's like, cool, yeah, there's a way you can fuse, like, hip hop and horror. I think there's an audience out there for it.
Oh, my God, yes.
Oh, there's huge audience out there
hip-hop
for
hip-hop and horror fans. Like, there's, like, a Venn diagram that's, like, almost a perfect circle.
I
want
to say shout-out to the Gravediggers, then, for all you hip-hop horror fans out there. Shout-out to the Gravediggers.
This is, like,
two
the
cups of blood.
Center of Ricky's Venn. Like, no, in terms of, it's also a great example when they say, write what you know, and then also build on what you love. So, like, they're setting it in a part of the city, in a background that they're familiar with as creators, and then also that layering on things they love as cinema viewers.
So absolutely.
I think those things could coalesce really nicely.
So there's a four-part Wu-Tang doc at Sundance called Wu-Tang Clan of Mics
and
Men.
Oh, you know I helped program that.
Well,
that's a must.
Well.
Is that right? Damn, Treya!
Come on.
That's what I'm talking
It's going to air on Showtime later this year. But also at doc at Sundance is the Michael Jackson documentary.
Also in my section.
Leaving Neverland. Directed by Dan Reed, causing quite a stir. It's a four-hour documentary interviewing two alleged victims that claim to have been sexually abused as minors by Michael Jackson. This past week, the Jackson estate denounced the film and released a statement calling it the kind of tabloid character assassination Michael Jackson endured in life and now in death. HBO will air the documentary this spring. Is this important? Do you care?
This one, so yes, this is Finding Neverland is in the section that I help program, and it is a very difficult view, and I think that what it has to say about everything from how trauma is processed and to how celebrity influences decision-making to, like, it's doing a ton of work, and it's also, it's very long. It's 4 hours.
Right.
And
screening with an intermission at Sundance.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And it's in the episodics, which is what I do there, because it is split up. And part of why I think that length is important is getting the full breadth of these interviews. It primarily focuses on two alleged victims who are supporting, they're telling their stories from when they're small children, and then also you're seeing their family, and then like there's supporting, corroborating imagery in terms of them being together, them being on tour, and what was allowed, and there's something just watching it. And I think the other thing that's really interesting and important about it, I do think this is important and I do care. I forgot to answer the question. But Tarana Burke, who originated the Me Too movement, met with them in Park City. And in talking to them, I've just read a quote from her that I thought was really striking about so far a lot of what we've discussed, or what the movement has discussed and brought up, is how women have been affected by sexual assault, and having two men who are now in their 40s discuss being victims as boys and going through that, and how we talk about that, how it changes how we discuss child sexual assault. So because we do look at things, much like men and women are judged differently, boys and girls are also treated just differently. Mm-hmm. So there's so much in this that I think is interesting. And watching the reactions online of Michael Jackson's fans, like every single intense, insane, vehement reaction, I'm like, you are you don't know it, but you are proving the point of these kids' mindset when they went through it, because they both initially...
Didn't both these kids testify in various trials that they had not been molested?
Yes, they had both testified in the court of law that they had not been abused by him. Yeah.
But that was all part of the being in
exactly.
his...
Exactly.
The estate argues also that the... that they are perjurers if they did. And they're just like, so you're going to believe the word of a perjurer? And they've like lied on the stand.
An 11-year-old perjurer.
And then also said that at least one of them brought up the allegations only after Michael Jackson denied a role in a show to him, which is just
as a
like
choreographer. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's also like, yeah, that could happen. Like, you may realize that, like, you know, this person who you thought was so close to you, like, denies you something that you thought you'd trust, and then all of a sudden they throw you away, and that might begin the deprogramming. It may have nothing to do with like money, prestige, or maybe it does a little bit, but it's like it's enough to deprogram, I think.
Yeah.
The reviews have been really strong for this. I'm very much looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, I really want to see that.
The Dark Universe is dead. Long live the Dark Universe?
They gave it their best shot.
last May, Universal Studios announced the launch of the Dark Universe. The plan was to remake all the Universal monster features, with Russell Crowe as Mr. Hyde, Johnny Depp as the Invisible Man, Javier Bardem as Frankenstein's monster, and Sofia Boutella as the Mummy. But the first movie in the shared universe, The Mummy with Tom Cruise, bombed so hard at the box office that... a lot of things were wiped out after that. According to Variety, this past week, Universal joined forces with Blumhouse Productions, and now they're moving forward with an Invisible Man remake, only it's without Johnny Depp. So now the Dark Universe is dead? Alive? It's dead alive. Is this important? Do you care?
I care about it because I like seeing these movies brought back and done with like today's technology. I remember when... The Wolfman came out a few years back with Benicio del Toro, and I was like really excited for it, and I thought that was great casting, but the movie just wasn't.
They had a ton of behind the scenes problems.
That's right. Yeah, like a director left.
It was Mark Romanek. Yeah,
that is correct. And I just thought the movie was kind of a hot mess. But I think The Invisible Man, like, these are just great stories, They're great books.
I don't think the directors who are taking on these things thus far, I don't think they're artists. They're not artists in the way that James Whale was a fucking artist, Like, he's not just, like, making a big-budget movie. He's making fucking art. Like, what he made stands the test of time because it's beautiful and odd and surreal and atmospheric.
The only reason I kind of wanted the Dark Universe to... continue was because there was the promise of Bill Condon doing The Bride of Frankenstein.
We had been talking about
a bunch, and that would have been awesome. But if that's not going to happen, I think that handing it off to Blumhouse is an interesting idea because I don't love all of their movies, but I think they're very intuitive and understanding about what works in horror and what contemporary horror audiences want to see. And, you know, when you think about it, the Hammer films of the 50s and 60s were kind of the modern version of the 1930s Universal horror movies. So now this is going to be sort of the early 21st century version, yet again, of those stories. So I think that there is something sort of archetypal about these characters that you can kind of keep retelling them for different eras and put a different spin on them, and they are both timeless and specifically of a time.
Yeah, I'm just going to need Blumhouse to step it up and not make these movies flat, though, because most of their films kind of ring flat to me. There's like the ones that stand out where I'm like, oh, that's clearly good, but vast majority are just kind of flat. They're like, oh, here's a movie. Go see it, and then I just get
more
kinda...
Happy Death Day, less Truth or Dare.
Right. Well, the other thing with this is, I think, especially that it's The Invisible Man, and first off, I'm thrilled Johnny Depp is no longer involved. He can eat all of the things to eat. But I love The Invisible Man. I love all of the Universal monsters. Mm-hmm. They're so great, and I think the worry of having the hook of the monsters is how they interpret them. I would love to have like an updated retro feel to these. The technology, because it's The Invisible Man, is fascinating, but I truthfully would love if they played with practical elements. Like, I feel there's a way to imbues some personality. But mm-hmm. there's also, if you look at the story, The Invisible Man is based on an H.G. Wells story. Mm-hmm. And to me, there's so much potential for metaphor. There's a whole thing about addiction with it. Like the doctor who's right. made himself invisible, like can't stop taking things. Like there's so many routes they could take that could be really exciting. So
yeah. And yeah. Lee Whannell is directing this mm-hmm. first one, mm-hmm. which I loved Upgrade. It's one of my favorite little low budget gems.
Did he do Escape Room?
No, I think he maybe wrote. He might have written it. I don't know that he directed it.
I'll ask Alonzo. He knows everything.
Oh. Escape Room was fun. I liked it. I'm going to call it now a remake of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, but with the cast of a Broad City.
Would watch. Would watch.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I would give that a lot. I would give that all of my money. Yeah. I believe I would
give
that all
would
my
produce.
Money.
I'm going to option that for you right now for a can of Coke.
Yeah, well, let's talk about some option ideas, and we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will be talking Stan and Ollie.
Is there a dog in a car at a bar on the street?
Yay! I'm Alec Gringo, a small dog owner. My dog Pistachio howls when she's excited.
And I'm Renee Culvert, a big dog owner. My dog Tugboat tips over when he's sleepy.
And we co-host a podcast called Can I Pet Your Dog that airs every Tuesday. We bring you all things dog.
Yes, dog news, dog tech, dogs we met this week. We also have pretty famous guests on Butt Legs. We're not going to let them talk about their projects.
No.
Just want to hear about those dogs.
We don't want to hear about your stuff. Only your dogs. So join us every Tuesday on Max Fun.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back to Who Shot Ya. I'm your host, Ricky Carmona. Joining me in the studio today are...
April Wolf.
Drea Clark.
Alonzo Duraldi.
On this episode, we are talking about Stan and Ollie. And Alonzo, I have not asked you to do synopsises in the past, but since this was actually kind of... when this movie was released, Alonzo was talking about in the studio, and you were a big fan of it. So can you tell us a little bit about what the movie was, and then what made you... want us to see
sure.
Stan and Ollie.
So it's about the legendary comedy team of Stan, Laurel, and Oliver Hardy, who are played by Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly. The film opens at the apex of their fame. They are the biggest comedy stars in Hollywood, and there's this extraordinary long tracking shot taking them from their dressing room to the set of Way Out West. And then we jump forward a couple of decades to the late 50s, and they have not worked together in a while. They aren't really making movies anymore. They are touring English music halls in the hopes of getting together a new film that will be a parody of Robin Hood. And Hardy has gotten heavier over the years. He is less spry. He's having health issues. But nonetheless, they soldier on, and their wives at one point join them, and they're hilarious. That's a whole other thing. and ultimately, as they're going through this tour, they kind of have to come to a reckoning of what is their friendship and how much of it is based on their professional life and, you know, the kinds of regrets and recriminations that stack up over the decades, you know, in a working partnership. I wanted to do it because I thought it was a terrific movie, and I thought it avoided a lot of the pitfalls that I feared it, you know, indulging in. Like, I thought it might be too maudlin. I thought the recreations would be bad. Like, I thought, you know, and I think it nails a lot of that stuff. But also, I just think in a larger sense, I thought it'd be interesting to have a conversation about movies about movie making and what they get right, or at least what feels right to those of us who aren't filmmakers ourselves, and what always kind of maybe comes off as contrived.
What did you feel that they got right about movies making movies? And this is for everybody. This isn't just for
everybody. Well, I mean, the specifics about Laurel and Hardy's relationship in terms of the fact that, like, they never did own their own stuff the way that, like, Charlie Chaplin or Harold Lloyd did. The fact that Hardy did make this movie by himself because he was still under contract to Hal Roach after Laurel had left. You know, I thought they nailed a lot of that stuff. But really, most of the film isn't so much about the filmmaking process as much as it's about kind of partnerships and, you know, like these sort of blurred lines between people who are sort of thrust together and people who are genuinely friends. Just a lot of little things along the way in terms of, like, you know, I love the shady tour director and how he's constantly, like, blaming this nameless them for what's happening. We're like, well, we thought you were in charge. Oh, so did I.
I went to university with him.
Really?
And I didn't realize it. I was like, Rufus? Like, there was a point I hit it. I was like, he, I thought, killed it. And the in terms of how the entertainment industry worked, he was perfect. I was like, oh, that guy is still around. The kind of talking around things they keep. He mentions, he keeps speaking in sort of third person. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, we had to book you. Who's we?
Yeah.
I thought you booked this. Oh, well, then, who's over there? Like, these misdirects. And the other small recurring thing that just talked to me, so throughout this, you mentioned the Robin Hood parody that they're hoping to make, and that this tour they're doing is, it's all leading up to this movie, which is the big stuff. And I was like, oh, I'm the producer who's not raising the money. I'm like, oh, that's a great idea. Like, Laurel and Hardy, they even show us some sort of fantasy elements of what these scenes would be. I mean, that'd be a great movie. Why can't it get the funding together? I feel for that producer, man.
But also, like, the wives who are played by Nina Arianda and Shirley Henderson, who are a great comedy duo unto themselves, also are like Hollywood vets. You know, Arianda's character, who's married to Laurel, was a dancer. I dance for Preston Sturges, you know, and I dance for Harold Lloyd. And
she mentioned that?
Yeah, exactly. And then the Ollie's wife was a script supervisor, script girl, as they used to call them back then.
Scripties.
They're in this relationship, kind of understanding the business the way more than like if they had married, you know, a civilian might have.
Mm-hmm. I wish they would have showed us more of like the. I wanted to see more like the behind the scenes. Like when I saw like the orchestra in the theater that they're playing in front of, I was like, oh man, that's right. They used to literally needed to have like an orchestra back there. All the scenes where they were like on set and film, like I really wanted. I wanted to see more of that. Because that's just such like a – things were just done so differently back then, you know, and just to be able to see the process of it would have been like amazing, would have been fantastic.
I enjoyed – you know, you mentioned the partnership of it, and there's a really – it's a very subtle thread of these men whose entire lives are spent together, and they spend all their time talking, and mostly what they're talking is nonsense. It's about bits. It's about future bits.
I think that might have been my favorite line in the movie. Enough bits.
Enough bits, yeah.
And then, I was like, that's how we talk.
Yeah.
All right, but we got it.
The idea that these men in this world are still almost incapable of like emotional intimacy with each other, that we're watching them 20 years past their prime, only finally talking about something that happened 20 years before. And you're like, wait, you guys are together. How have you not talked about this thing? And that realization and how men it made me think about that thread in a really interesting way.
Everyone's looking at me.
April, you haven't said anything.
Very
quiet. I'm listening. You know, I felt like the structure was really artful, and that's something that I appreciate in a film. Like Drea said, whenever there's a stage show that they do, whether it's the train station or whether it's, Stan and Laurel in the hospital, there's a callback later on to what that is. So all of the comedy is not there just to showcase, you know, how funny these acts are and how kind of enduring they are, because they are still funny. That kind of physical comedy is just like, it's so good, and it's so good to see it recreated. But it has meaning to the story beyond it just being an interesting reenactment of their bits.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that structure was really wonderful. And I like that they can cut out the fat of like moving through time. That's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Because you are going, like, you're spanning, like, 20 years, and it's just difficult to do well.
I thought they really avoided the mistake very well of showing us a biopic where they just show us their whole career.
Yeah.
I like that we got this moment at the beginning, and then we got to when things aren't going so well. It's like, I don't think everybody is as familiar with the Stan and Ollie story. But the fact that we're so familiar to biopics and we just kind of know what is going to happen, the fact that it skips over all the good stuff and just gets to here's when things get rocky, I was like, oh, you have my attention. I'm very much in.
They did a great job of the show don't tell adage of giving us, especially I was thinking of that when I watched it. I'm like, wait, our first act setup is that I'm supposed to take away that there is a contract dispute that between them. Do you know what I mean? It's like a pretty heady, I was like, that must factor in later because this is really specific information I'm getting.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm also seeing their rapport. I'm seeing them on their top of the world. But that's worked in so nicely. And then it's also that when you revisit them again and they're like rolling into this kind of crap B&B looking and that even the desk clerk girl who's checking them in and asks where they're performing once she recognizes them and they tell her and she's like, no.
No, that can't be right.
That can't be. You'll be at a better place. And they're like, we are not. That is right.
And I do love an old school. Like this is such a sort of trope that it becomes a joke in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. But I love walking through a movie studio where there's like Roman centurions and showgirls and an elephant and all that stuff, you know, just for no apparent reason. So I kind of love that they brought that back for this.
That
shot
is amazing. It's like the first, like, it goes forever. Yeah. The other thing they do a great job of, biopics, any film where someone is playing, not just like someone in history, but these guys were playing movie stars. So whether or not you're a Laurel and Hardy fan, you've seen their pictures, you've probably seen a gif of them on Twitter. But like,
or just you've seen drawings of them, like caricatures.
Exactly.
You know
who they
are. You're
familiar with them. So it's even riskier territory to have people play entertainment figures because you have such a visual connected with them. And I think they did a great job of fleshing those characters out. Like even in that long tracking shot, they do these things where like they'll pause and like, because they are very clearly, they're both sort of talking about like how many divorces they've already gone through. And every time they pass a group of women, they're like, hey girls, and they do this. They do little bits and the bits of it are so organic and so you're like, oh, that is part of how they communicate. And you reference it back to any visuals you have of them as entertainers. And it's threaded so nicely into these fully realized characters.
Yeah, because like I think in some movies when you see like they're playing a famous person and they're doing the famous person's bit, it feels inorganic. Like they're doing it just so you'll recognize it. Like there's been an argument made that really in Mommy Dearest, you're watching Faye Dunaway do Joan Crawford's other movies. Like she's doing scenes from Queen Bee or Mildred Pierce or whatever, you know. But like in here, these guys are such vaudevillians and such sort of old school shticky comedians that they can't not, as you say, they can't not do it. So when they see those girls, for instance, like, you know, Hardy will grab the tie and ruffle it and Stan will take the derby off and scratch the top of his head with his fingertips, you know. But it scans as something that these guys would do because that was a shorthand for them to be like, hey, I'm this famous person, you're talking to me, you know. And so yeah, it brings you in and it never feels like it's this contrived thing. And yeah, this movie did kind of take me through that magical veil where I stopped seeing Coogan and Riley and just saw Laurel and Hardy, which I very rarely get to experience. I think the last time that happened literally was Behind the Candelabra. When I stopped seeing Michael Douglas and I just saw Liberace.
I was just going to say, did you guys, so John C. Reilly, I had heard, you know, that he was the performance to look out for. But I actually didn't prefer, I mean, you don't have to choose one or the other. I was so taken by Steve Coogan's Stan Laurel. There were times, because I feel like I'm so familiar with Laurel's face, and there were times he just did these small face movements and he didn't have the fat suit or the makeup stuff that, I mean, he did have lengthening makeup or whatever, but there were times he was doing things I was like, that is so perfect and so sad. And there's this one moment when he's trying to get in to see this producer, the Drea Clark character, and this amazingly snotty receptionist is sort of, so he tries to kind of win her over by doing a bit of his act. Like he does this stuff with his hat to try and make her laugh. And it is the saddest. There was something about, I was,
it's
like,
kind of
I wanted to weep.
God, that guy is so good at desperate, though.
I think
after like a full body of work of just desperation characters, like all of them.
He does bring a lot of flop sweat to a lot of different movies, but intentionally so.
Can we discuss the women?
Please.
Those two, I always want to say Florence Henderson, but it's Shirley Henderson.
Shirley Henderson.
Yeah, I'm wrong with the Florence. And then I swear the other woman, did she
Nina
play
Arianda.
Did she play a similar character in Florence
Foster Jenkins.
Foster Jenkins?
Yes, she did. And she was on Masters of Sex. She's been on Goliath.
Okay.
And she won a Tony for Venus and Furs.
Okay. I haven't seen her in the TV stuff, but I remembered her from Florence Foster Jenkins.
Flo-Flo J.
Flo-Flo J. And she's an incredible presence. The two women are so crackling and have so much energy and so much rapport with each other. And they're sharp with each other. Like, they are not women who would be friends in real life.
Yes.
But you're like, oh yeah, your husbands
stuck together.
Are partners, so you're stuck together. And then there's a moment of sort of grace between the two of them. I made me bawl at the end. Also, I watched this on my birthday.
This movie was like, you were in the spirit.
This I was like, I didn't cry, but I thought it was moving.
Yeah. Maybe bawl is too much. I did a...
I went to an early press screening of this with a friend of mine because they showed it early because I think it premiered at the London Film Festival in like September or October or something. And, you know, we both went in. Like I said, I was very trepidatious because I thought it was going to be this really sappy thing of like, ooh, the sad clown, you know, or they were going to try and recreate bits and it was going to just be not good, you know. Mm. But he cried like three or four different times. I was like, all right. I didn't go that far, but I see where you're getting it. I mean, there's some moments for here for sure.
Can I shut a curtain around Ricky for a second? Just like a curtain.
Okay, all right, cool.
I think that John C. Reilly performance in The Sisters Brothers is better than this performance here.
I think they're both great.
I think they're both great, but the idea that he did both of those in the same year,
I know.
They're similar but not. I think that's
no. Some would say John C. Reilly is the Brian Tyree Henry of
white guys.
Irish white guys. Yeah.
No, I went into award season being like John C. Reilly, and no one cared. Okay, yeah. So you know.
Well, John C. Reilly and Brian Tyree Henry can have like we'll have a party for them.
There you go.
I would watch their movie.
I even forgive him Holmes and Watson for this Ooh. Movie and Sisters Brothers.
Oh wow. I saw this movie. I saw it today. I saw it at the AMC in Burbank.
Oh, you're fresh.
fresh. I was the only person of color there. But it was great because I felt like I was in a theater back in the hood because, like, old white people, they also will just talk during a movie. They don't give a shit. And I could hear people when like she grabbed her hand at the end, like, they're friends.
That's what my heart said.
Yeah. Like when the shady theater owner was talking, a gentleman behind me was like, he doesn't know. They don't know they're getting robbed right now. Like, that is correct, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
You're helping me a great deal.
Well, let's go around and let's tell the people what we thought. Should they screen it, stream it, or skip it?
Oh, screen it for sure. I you know, four great performances, if nothing else. But I think also a really well-crafted showbiz story. And, you know, I think really kind of it's one of the better movies I think that I've seen about performers and I mean just sort of about comedy and about performing comedy and you know, the real life behind that. Mm.
This is tricky. I think I would say stream it only because it felt like such an intimate movie for me. I feel like I would actually enjoy watching it on my laptop, like a weird hermit, which is how I normally watch things. I would definitely think people should see it and would enjoy it. I think it's an easy view and a nice little bit of film history too.
I'm somewhere between stream and screen it because I maybe didn't like it as much as Alonzo did, but I have a great admiration for it. The recreations that they did, it's just really fucking phenomenal. And
Back and watch the real ones. You'll be amazed.
Yeah, exactly. And they also, you know, during the credits, they do play some of the real ones and you're like, oh, damn. Like, this is so, so faithful to the original. So I don't know. I'm somewhere between it. If you have it playing in a theater near you, then
scream it. Yeah.
I could tell that was really them in the credits because that same gentleman behind me was like, that's really them. Thank you, sir.
I hope you got his number.
He's joining the panel next week.
I feel like because I'm a comedian and I perform legally, I need to support this movie, stream it. But I'm like April, where I'm actually more in like the stream it or skip it.
Strip it.
Strip this mug, yo. Scrap it. It's It was just, to me, it was just fine. I wanted more kind of like, maybe, I think I wanted a little bit more sad clown or just like a little bit. There was, I feel like the hardest part of this movie was making that comedy seem very interesting to me, somebody my age, where when I think of like comedy duos, like Laurel and Hardy is just not my go-to. They're what I say like when I'm filling out the form and like influences in comedy. Well, of course, Laurel and Hardy, they were like one of the first ones. But as far as like, is this my world of like stand-up? Like, or I'm sorry, like my world of like comedy in general, and will, can I tell like, you know, my fucking 15-year-old niece, yo, you need to holler at this Laurel and Hardy movie. She'll be like,
I
don't
know
if there's like enough in the movie to like really hit like a younger crowd.
60 years from now, the comedy kids who juggle their own internal organs will look back at your material and be like, it just doesn't speak to me. Yeah.
60 years from now, I'm going to tell them to not watch my material. I'm going to tell them to watch Eddie and Arsenio or Richard Pryor.
Because I'm younger
than
you and I like it. But I can also picture myself being in the theater. And I think having been a person who has gone to see Carrot Top and laughed my fucking ass off and was like, what the fuck? Why am I laughing so hard? I think it's just, it makes sense to me having had that experience being like, if I were in this audience and I would see these people commit to these acts that just kind of push it, almost in like what we have with David Wayne now when he does things, he does a similar kind of like slapstickish stuff. I think I would still be like, I would be laughing very hard in the theater.
All right. Yeah. All right. Okay.
I'm defending Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah, you are. Yeah.
Thank
you. Yeah.
And don't be ashamed of saying you love Carrot Top either. I love Carrot Top. It's dope.
That guy works. He works for it, dude.
He does. Carrot Top is funny. All right. Well, Stan and Ollie is in theaters now. You can go see it if you'd like it, as Alonzo says. But we are going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to take a call from the Who Shot line.
Hello, this is Amy Mann.
And I'm Ted Leo.
And we have a podcast called The Art of Process. We're talking about how the creative process is in itself an art form, in our opinion. There are underlying forms and structures that serve as a scaffolding for any creative endeavor.
We've been lucky enough over the past year to talk to some of our friends and acquaintances from across the creative spectrum to find out how they actually work.
We weirdly don't know as many musicians as you would expect.
New episodes will be coming every other Monday,
starting January 28th.
So please listen and subscribe at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back to Who Shall Ya? I'm your host, Ricky Carmona. Join me in the studio today are
Drea Clark,
Alonzo Duraldi,
April Wolf.
We are going to take a call from the Who Shot line now. Thank you to everyone who calls in and leaves a voicemail. So let's go ahead and listen to, I believe we have a message from Kate.
Hi, Ricky, April, Alonzo, and anyone else there in the gang. My name is Kate, and I have a question for you guys regarding April talking about Hereditary and how the Academy usually ignores genre films and performances in them. Specifically this year, I think Lin Shaye in Insidious: The Last Key and Logan Marshall Green in Upgrade were stellar, but completely overlooked because it was a genre film, and I wanted to know if there are any movies in the past that you think have an incredible performance that was overlooked. Thank you.
These are exactly why I want these questions in advance. Guys. You know that I wish I could do some homework right now.
What was the second part of her question?
Performances we think were overlooked.
Performances that were
because
overlooked.
They were in genre films.
Because they're genre. Fucking films. All okay. Of the genre films that work. I'm serious.
For starters, I think the only genre nominations, and maybe I'm missing out here, but like apart from like Silence of the Lambs, which is, you know, iffy because it's also a policier or whatever, but like Kathy Bates.
He made a horror and he called it a horror movie, so it's a horror
okay,
movie.
Okay, fine, it's a horror movie. So them, Kathy Bates in Misery, Sigourney Weaver in Aliens.
Yes.
Is that kind of it?
No.
Well,
because
is genre just, I mean, when we're talking genre, are we just considering horror and sci-fi? I mean, does the list stop there?
I think it's, I would include both of those because I think, maybe
I would definitely include both of those.
I would include those too because I think those are the ones that are left out.
Yeah.
Okay. But like, I would go back and say that there's things like Mia Farrow in Rosemary's Baby is doing such specific work that's kind of this line between drama and camp that is really hard to sustain. And she's playing someone who's emotionally and psychologically, you're never really sure.
Unbalanced.
And there's Ruth Gordon in that performance as well.
Which won an Oscar.
Won an Oscar, so that's not overlooked.
That's true. And also, Frederick March in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, didn't he win an Oscar for that?
He won a couple, so I'm going to say yes.
I'm thinking he did.
Did Natalie Portman get hers for Black Swan?
Yes.
She did. Yep.
True.
So I agree. Obviously, I talked about Upgrade earlier today, so Logan Marshall Green did a really fucking great performance in Upgrade.
Do you think he should have been nominated for an Oscar for it? I'm very excited to watch his Upgrade movie.
Honestly, if we're just looking at technique... Yeah, okay. I think he could have been.
We are not giving Logan Marshall Green an Oscar before we give one to Tom Hardy.
No, that's the thing.
But when Tom Hardy's like, I won't take that role, Logan Marshall Green is like, I will.
I would get on that camp, though.
Yeah, it's I do truly believe that every horror film that works has an incredible performance that was under-awarded because horror films and genre movies in general, they require really good acting to not be a fucking joke.
Yeah.
You know, and even the ones that are kind of a joke, like if I look at, I can't remember her name, the woman who plays Frankenhooker.
She's committed.
She is hilarious and she is so good in this movie. And as I was, you know, rewatching it before, I was just like, yeah, this fucking woman, she is so amazing. She was like an adult star and she only did a couple of movies, including Frankenhooker, but she's so good. And if I look, you know, Nicolas Pesci's got a movie coming out soon, which I fucking love. It's called Piercing. And his movie, The Eyes of My Mother, had a lead actress. I can't remember her name. I think she might be Argentinian, but she had also one of the best, most nuanced performances of like a woman who's kind of coveting people's bodies and wanting them to be her friends for forever. Is likable and sexy. And
did she get a Spirit Award nomination? I know that film did. Got a few.
I don't think that she did specifically.
Okay. My go to is always Terry O'Quinn in The Stepfather.
Wow.
Ooh.
That is one of the great movie performances of all time.
He's great.
And that movie, it works entirely on his shoulders, like what April was saying. Like, yes, the other people in it are good, but like he has to have that level of commitment of who this guy is and what he's capable of and the facades that he presents to the world. Hands down, that is a great, great performance.
There's certain movies, like scary movies that came out in the 80s, like I just remember seeing, and like The Stepfather was like, I'm not wrong in saying this, like pretty low budget movie.
Yeah.
And I had never seen Terry O'Quinn before. I don't think anybody did. And like, this dude just walked in off the street. Yeah. He's really crazy.
Where'd you find The Stepfather?
Yeah, yeah. Like I just firmly believed like he's the one. Like he did it in real life and then they cast him in the movie. He's that great in it.
There's also Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer is one of my favorites. And I'm sorry, his name is Michael Rooker.
Yeah. Rooker.
A lot of younger people now know from Guardians of the Galaxy, having played an amazing character in that. Right. He actually delivers a fantastic performance there.
Mallrats.
Yes.
Ah, Slither. Hello.
Yes.
He's so good
in
Slither.
Yeah.
I'm talking about like the younger people though, like who might not even know Slither or Mallrats.
They should. Slither was made by James Gunn.
Slither's so good. It's underrated. Underrated, underseen. Slither's great. I was asking about genre because I think a genre that also just gets completely forgotten at the Oscars is comedy as well.
Well,
I
mean, that's a whole other. Yeah. Yes,
like,
for sure.
I would say. Eddie Murphy in The Nutty Professor. Like, he's fucking amazing in that, and he's playing seven different roles, and he's playing it with makeup, and he's playing against himself. I mean, that's mind-boggling what he does in that movie. In action films,
they didn't nominate Peter Sellers for playing three roles in Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, and I was going to say, combining those two, Simon Pegg and Shaun of the Dead, I think delivers a fantastic performance.
And in The World's End.
Yes, and really kind of moving, hilarious, and like a great horror performance too, you know?
He plays it so real that it's great.
Yes,
yeah, it's really great. Yeah, when he has to like kill his dad in that, is that right?
mom.
And Kelly's mom in that, that scene is like, oh.
It still brings me to tears.
I'm sorry. I was wrong. Peter Sellers was nominated for an Oscar for Doctor Strangelove.
So. I thought you said he was.
No, no. I thought he was. I thought he wasn't. But no, he actually was. Because usually when comedian, I mean, when Mike Myers does it, I think of Eddie Murphy. When Eddie Murphy does it, I think of Peter Sellers doing it. That whole, like, I'm going to be everybody in this movie. You know?
But part of Doctor Strangelove, though, it still speaks to Ricky's point because it's a comedic role, but it's not. It's a comedy film, sort of, but it's not like, oh, you know what? I just like a nice, relaxing time at the theater and have some chuckles. Like, Dr. Strangelove has so much going on, and it's
Vice is
it's
also
Kubrick.
A comedy,
like,
so.
Yeah, exactly. True. The Golden Globes would acknowledge it as a comedy, yeah. But not everyone would. But yeah, no, I agree. There's definitely, it's interesting, though, some of the best comedic performances are often tempered with, like, tragedy, so that's why that a straightforward comedy isn't always as recognized.
I feel like when a comedic performance is nominated, it's usually somebody giving a comedic performance in a movie that's actually more like a drama or a dramedy, and they're kind of like what stands out because there's such a relief when they show up on film and they get awarded. But outside of that, I mean, yeah, like
They're the Tom Hanks effect.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, occasionally you'll get like a Kevin Kline in A Fish Called Wanda, but that's very much the exception.
I mean, that's
rule.
One of the best.
Yeah, so he's so good.
Yeah.
I also think that my man Bruce in the Evil Dead movies.
Oh, hell yes.
His performances are like, he invented a type.
Yeah.
He invented a character type, and he so destroyed it that it's just like he continues playing it because, and he can play other characters, but he's just so fucking good at this character.
I watched Evil Dead 2 for the first time again in a long time about 2 weeks ago. And like I've watched Evil Dead 2 a million times. And the first Evil Dead is just played so like straight and like for like the scares. So when you see him like be funny in Evil Dead 2, I mean that shit is like what he's doing is other level in that movie. Yep. The scene where he's fucking breaking and his hand is possessed.
Yeah.
That's other level.
Yeah.
That's other level. Yeah. Anthony Hopkins ain't doing that.
Long live
no
Ash
disrespect.
The Evil Dead. Although Anthony Hopkins delivers a fantastic
He will eat you with what Chianti and some fava beans, so you better respect him.
I have not circled back to Silence of the Lambs in ages, but I remember the year that came out being adamant that that was a supporting performance.
Mm.
And like being kind of annoyed that he got a lead Oscar, because I remember thinking like that, because he's in the movie. I mean, has anybody sat down and timed
it's supporting.
It's pretty, yeah, I would think it's a pretty short performance, and like I was really wanting Nick Nolte
it
to win that year.
It tells me,
you know.
I was like, he was probably... They looked at the two categories, the studio, and decided which one he had a better shot at.
Oh, always, yeah.
I had one other hot take from the Oscars last week of somebody who should have gotten nominated, and I'm expected for all the crazy looks you're all about to give me. But Tom Cruise for Best Actor in a Mission Impossible. The amount of stunt work that he does in that movie and the talk that has been going around of like, hey, how about we get an Oscar for stunt work? Well, here's somebody who's doing both of those things at the top of his game. Like, it's not a silly performance that he gives in that movie. You don't watch it and roll your eyes like, oh, whatever. He's doing Tom Cruise things in him, like fucking running and all that. But he's also, I mean, he's jumping out of a plane. He's riding that motorcycle.
And that's acting.
You guys,
it's not just acting.
Tom Cruise should have gotten an Oscar for Tropic Thunder. So I don't know why any of his other performances would ever come up.
No, I mean, I like that hot take. I like that hot take, yo. That's what I'm saying. Well, Kate, I hope we answered your question all right there. Does anybody else got any Oscar hot takes?
A lot, but let's just move on.
All right. Yeah.
Be here all night.
Well, then let's go on to our staff picks, y'all. Every week at the end of the show, we give you all a staff pick, something we think you folks should check out. Dre, I'll start with you.
Okay, so my film is a small indie that I programmed at LA Film Fest, RIP, 2 years ago. It is currently on Hulu. It is called Everything Beautiful is Far Away, and it's directed by Pete Oz and Andrea Sisson. And it's the kind of I'm doing this because I was flipping through Hulu, probably because I'd finished Letterkenny, and was looking for something, and it was suggested to me, and I was like, Everything Beautiful is Far Away. It's my favorite kind of new talent discovery film. It's a two-hander sci-fi set in the desert, stars Joseph Cross and Julia Garner, and he's They're both two people wandering around in the future where they're in the desert. They're looking for sort of a mythical water source, and they encounter each other. And the only other companion is the disembodied robot head, Susan, that he's carrying with him. And the world building and the set design, and how it's gorgeously shot. The director, Pito, was also the cinematographer. So, it's just one of those kind of talent discovery films that as a programmer is so exciting. And it turns, like, the story moves along like it's supposed to, because in such sparse settings, it could be really difficult. And there's so much beautiful detail. Like, they build all of these small little, it's not steampunk, but it has that kind of tactile technological component with organic stuff. Mm. And there's, like, an entire fruit that they made. And so, like, the art design of it, it's really lovely. So
all right. I fuck with fruit.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a t-shirt.
Alonzo, what do you got?
Well, there are two movies that are in wide release right now and are both tanking. So if you're going to see them quickly. And one is great and one is terrible, but they're both worth checking out.
And he won't tell us what they are.
Holmes and Watson.
Actually, one is good and one is terrible. Great is putting too fine a point on it. Mm. But the good one is The Kid Who Would Be King, from our dear friend Joe Cornish, director of Attack the Block. And it's a charming kids movie about a bullied boy played by Louis Sherborne Circus, Andy Circus's son, who pulls a sword out of a stone and whoops, discovers that he is now the new king. And Merlin shows up to show him how to get his friends together to repel the evil sorceress Morgana, played by Rebecca Ferguson of the Mission Impossible movies.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not perfect, but it's a lot of fun and really charming. And I think people would have a good time with it and, take your kids, whatever. And then the bad one is Serenity, which is so bad that you kind of want to see it immediately because it has a twist in it that is so dumb and opens so many more unsettling questions than the movie already had going into it that it's just bonkers. But without giving anything away, it starts out as this very sort of sweaty neo-noir with Matthew McConaughey as a fishing boat owner, and a woman from his past played by Anne Hathaway shows up and is like, I want you to kill my rich husband. But it gets so much crazier from there. And it's from the writer-director of Locke, which is a movie I love, but this one is terrible, but like the kind of terrible that you'll want to talk to friends about. So like, take your friends, go see it. You'll most likely be in an empty theater anyway, so just to have fun with it and live tweet it if you feel like it. And yeah, Serenity, it's bananas.
I did the rare fuck it, I need to know what the twist is, and read what it was, and I was like, oh, I'm watching this movie. I'm watching this hot mess.
Don't tell me what it is.
I definitely will not.
I'm so excited.
That was like the beginning or the headline of like every article I saw about that movie. I was like, I just got to know what the fuck it is.
They kind of give away the game in the very first shot of the film, but I remember thinking, oh, no, it can't be that, right? And then later, oh, no, it is. Okay, all right.
Oh, hell yeah. April, what do you got?
I'm going with an oldie that I rented the other day from Videotech. It is called Day of the Jackal. It's a Zinzemann film, and it won a BAFTA for best editing, and I think for good reason, although my husband, who is an editor, is just like, editing was different back then, because he got mad that, like,
people had attention spans.
Exactly. It's like a procedural, and it's very kind of that docudrama time of, the style that was happening in the 1970s, and I just really like dry things. Like, the emotions from this run the gamut from disheveled to frustrated. And it's British, but the story is essentially that there's this assassin who's hired by this right-wing insurgency in France to assassinate de Gaulle, the president of France. And so they hire a man who's probably British. And then British intelligence has to work with French intelligence to try to stop him. But you see equal time is given to both this guy, the Jackal, and to the people who are trying to stop him. So you know, like, every step of the way and, you know, how close they are. And I just, I love it. I thought it was really tense and it's long, but it's so good. It's so well constructed.
Mm. I like the description of a guy that was probably British, because that's how I refer to Christian Bale. Like, every time he's about to talk in his real accent, I'm like,
well, cause
he's
a guy who's probably British. I don't want
to
give anything away. Right. But there's something, there's stuff to do with like nationality and the secret identities and things.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, hell yeah. My side pick this week, it's a documentary that's streaming on Hulu right now called Keepers of the Magic. Oh, it is a dope ass documentary about cinematography and film. And it speaks to like all the legends. It talks to Gordon Willis, Roger Deakins, John Seale. It talks to current cinematographers today. And it's just like, I'm a sucker for like just like all the most beautiful shots in film. Like I can just watch those over and over. But then like they, you know, you'll see an amazing shot from a movie that I remember as a kid, like this movie called The Bear. And then they, you know, you're on the set watching like how it was filmed. And you know, from the cinematographer's point of view and like what they were trying to do. And really getting into like the philosophy of what they were trying to do within a frame and just like I was like, this is for me. Tell me more.
I wanted you to be pitching a documentary about Magic the Gathering.
I was like, this is not where it's going
to blow my mind.
So then we all meet in my basement.
You turned it a little more Ricky, but I was like, edge of my seat.
It's really great, though. I mean, it just like I said, just like listening to the philosophy. And some of them don't have a philosophy. Some of them are just very much like, you know, I believe that that's like the director's responsibility. It's just great to hear all sides of what it is they were trying to do in making movies and shooting film. Yo, it's so great. Keepers of the Magic. It's on Hulu. That's what's up. Next week, we are going to be talking about Miss Bala. Thank you to everybody who leaves 5-star reviews. On Apple Podcasts, if you leave us a 5-star review, we'll read it on the show like I'm about to do right now. This one comes from Giggleberry. Giggleberry says, I just love this podcast. I wait for it every week. And when I heard you all saying there weren't any reviews recently, I thought to myself, with Ricky's trademark spunk, oh, hell no. Please keep doing what you do. Your extensive movie knowledge and the playful convos between the usual gang and guests are always a joy. Here's to more Hushaya in 2019. Feliz Año Nuevo. Igualmente a tu Giggleberry. That's what's up.
And el WhatsApp.
Y un tremendo WhatsApp.
Al Green apparently speaks in Zaf Dingbats, but his review is heart emoji, high five emoji, movie projector emoji, grinning with glasses emoji, flame emoji, stars emoji. Thank you, Al Green. That's so kind of you.
I think that's good.
I'm going to assume it is.
Thank you all for being here. It's always a pleasure to see y'all. Always a pleasure to see y'all. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, why don't you tweet us at WhoShotYaPod or send us an email at WhoShotYa at MaximumFun.org. Leave us a voicemail on the WhoShot line. The number is WSY8031664. This week we talked about Stan and Ollie. If you want to call in and let us know what your favorite comedy duos were in the past, why don't you go ahead and do that? Try and leave your messages to less than a minute, though.
Be like Kate.
Yes.
Kate practiced, I could tell. She practiced.
Yes, yeah, she did. Yeah, if you need to have a script in front of you, go ahead and have a script in front of you.
Also have a script in front of us.
Literally. Literally. But go ahead and leave us a call on the WhoShot line. That would be dope. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of MaximumFun.org. And that's what's up, yo.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.